Dear listeners, thank you for tuning in to Hawa Amman 105.9 and welcome to a new program, Amman the Heartly Embrace, prepared by Nasser Rahamne and Shima Tal and presented by Katrina Hamane. In the program, we glimpse at our lovely city Amman through the eyes of diplomats and foreigners, catching their views, interactions and experiences, learn about their organizations, projects, initiatives and contributions to the city. Broadcasted on Saturday from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. and a replay on Tuesday from 8 to 9 p.m. Dear listeners, thank you for tuning to Hawa Amman 105.9 FM and welcome to another episode of Amman the Heartly Embrace, prepared by Nasser Rahamne and Shima Tal and presented to you by Katrina Hamarne. In the program, we'll glimpse at our lovely city Amman through the eyes of diplomats and foreigners and prominent Jordanians. We'll catch their memories, views, interactions and impressions. Learn about their organizations, projects, initiatives and contributions to Amman. Broadcasted on Saturday from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. and replayed on Tuesday from 8 to 9 p.m. Today, dear listeners, we have a very unique guest and we're very privileged to have with us Mrs. Anne Hutchinson-Sawalha, the author of autobiography Through the Palace Keyhole, recently published by Medina Publishers. And she is having in her nature the will of the West and the warmth of the East. Thank you so much for being with us, Anne. And today's music accompanying the program will be by Talal Abu Raghib. Thank you so much for coming. It wasn't easy, I think, today. It was a rainy day.
Thank you so much for having me, Karina. It's a pleasure to be able to talk to Amman and to introduce my book to people who might be interested in knowing a little bit more about how I see Jordan, Amman, and the Arab family.
I consider that you're a very brave person when you decided to write your memoirs. Usually people think of publishing them, you know, after a long time. So how did you decide to write your memoirs?
In actual fact, I didn't. It was sort of a process. Mm-hmm. I like to keep notes of things, and every year since I arrived in Jordan in 1959, I would send out a family newsletter.
Wow.
Instead of a Christmas card or something. And this turned out to be my major reference because for every year since 1959, I highlighted things in my life and in the family. So I had a great reference for this. And it would also trigger details, you know.
Right.
Without writing them down, you recall them. And as I get older, though, the details are a little bit more and more fuzzy. But anyway, it did help. And then in 1982, I had my mother come to live with me. She wasn't well. And by that time, I had already been here over 20 years. And she brought with her all the letters that I had written to her every week since I left home.
Wow, she kept everything.
She kept them for me, and she gave them to me, and she said, here, this will help you with your book. And that was the first thought I had of actually writing a book.
I thought when I was looking at the book, I thought that you had memoirs because actually you capture a lot of things in such details, which was really amazing. Mm-hmm. But it's really fantastic to have a newsletter. That's something that nobody think. But I guess, you know, the extended family, having part of your family in the States and part here, and then, you know, you were in Palestine, that actually maybe triggered and helped you, you know, thinking about that.
Well, some of it was that you couldn't buy Christmas cards.
Oh,
they were
that's
expensive.
True.
They weren't available. And this was an easy way. You could mimeograph off 50 pages without a lot of trouble. One page was all I would do. No artwork or anything like that. And just send it out. And it got to be a tradition.
Interesting. Yeah. I wonder, do your kids keep the same tradition or no?
No, I don't think so. I have one daughter who tends to do this, but I don't think in quite the same way that I did. We're all different.
You chose to name your book Through the Palace Keyhole. And usually when we look at keyholes, you know, it's like that forbidden, you know, you're sneaking out on somebody's life. So why did you decide that? Are you inviting the readers to sneak out on your life and look through the keyhole?
I have.
So mischievous.
I have to laugh, Katrina, because in the questions that you gave me ahead of time that you might be asking, when you... That was one of the questions, and I thought, huh, never entered my mind that usage of the word keyhole. It really didn't. It's more that it's a small opening.
Right.
And it's in a barrier.
Right.
A door. So I felt, of course, the barrier is the culture. It's the language. It's my inability to be totally assimilated.
Right.
So, and it's just a small opening. So it's what I could see or what I could glimpse through this opening into the
world
around me and back into the hotel as well.
Right.
Because I'm not a vital part of the hotel, although at this point I sort of am, but I have no authority. I really don't. I'm not involved at all in the running of the Regency.
You had enough, I suppose.
I had enough, yes, enough, yeah.
Well, I mean, it's for people, I think, who are coming now to Jordan or to any country, you have the internet, you have, you know, books, everything is available. But I think it was a huge, you know, adventure on your side. There wasn't even an airplane to take you directly to Jordan. And it was really courageous because you didn't know what to expect coming here. It was hard, I suppose.
You know, when you're young, you don't look at life quite like that. Thank goodness. the world is out there. Your life is out there. Time is there. It's on your side. And, of course, my husband, I was very much in love with my husband. And he was a good man. And wherever he wanted to go, I was going to go happily. And... of course, when I got here, I found it was such a different world.
Of course, yes.
But not bad. Not bad at all.
Well, coming to what it came to now, of course. But at the time, I mean, one of the things that I admire about the book, and that's what I felt, is that it really brings in the Amman that no longer is here. The history and Palestine and how you could at one point, you know, easily travel back and forth between, you know, just crossing the bridge. I know that later on things have changed. But it's really, it's like a frozen time which you take us there on a journey and show us the city that we hadn't seen and we will never be able to see. And that's what really makes the book unique because you're an eyewitnesser. So how was Amman when you came and first saw it?
To me, it was like a small town. Of course, I'm from Detroit, and at that time, it was a city of about 3 million people.
And wow.
We had a shopping mall or two. We had a few freeways, you know, expressways inside the city. And, of course, women drove, and women are working, and you have a totally different modern life. And to come here and find that most people don't have cars, they don't drive. And women didn't shop for food.
Yeah, that's true.
In those days. Women didn't do anything outside the home. A few teachers.
Yeah.
And a few in nursing, maybe.
Right.
A minority community of the, I think, Armenians. I can't remember. So, totally different reality.
Yes.
But not unpleasant. You know, it's like going through a door into a different place.
Right.
And that's... what's there. You deal with what you have there.
But you had a strong will and you were very courageous to actually come and continue because you could have, you know, said at any point, I can't cope and just pack your bags and leave. But you didn't do so and you kept on, you know. And that was really, you know, admirable.
Well, I didn't see it that way at all. I was, I felt welcomed. I felt challenged. And there was just so much I wanted to understand. And, of course, my husband was a major support in that he didn't dictate to me, you need to call Auntie so-and-so or we need to go here or go there. He totally let me be free to be who I was. And I think that helped so much that I wasn't confused and constrained.
Mm-hmm.
And you immediately, or at least for me, just fell into the pattern of what life was like.
But I think, and you could correct me, I might be wrong, is that your in-laws were working in the hotel business. So somehow they were more open-minded than the normal people around who have been in villages and never seen foreigners. Maybe that somehow helped, but I could be wrong.
I think it certainly helped. Right. And they also did come to the States for our wedding and stayed on for 8 months, which was a bit of a strange way to start a marriage.
Tell me.
I do put that in the book, and that was really more difficult than coming to Jordan, I must say.
Yeah, especially that you were saying that, you know, you were just newlyweds and you were living in a house with five, you know.
Yes, in my mother's home and with them. It was extremely taxing on what you expect and what you think you want and find out that the reality isn't that. Quite like that. But it was a chance to get to know a bit about Arab culture, sensitivity, and certainly food.
Right.
Yeah, before I even came to Jordan. And they, in turn, got to see how I lived.
Right.
The city I lived in, the kind of routine and life that we had. And that was a big help.
Yeah.
It was a big help.
So you managed somehow to bridge the cultures in between, just a teeny weeny
little bridge. Yes, actually, I think it was a very important bridge.
You have mentioned actually when you opened the book, you actually quote the story of Job by Archbishop MacLeish. You wanted justice, didn't you? There isn't any, and that was as a starting point. Somehow I was startled. Do you feel that there isn't justice in the Middle East? I mean, in a sense, it wasn't treated justly by the other big players. Why did you decide to start that with your, you know, book?
Oh, it's complicated. I think maybe not. I think, you know, some of the first sentences that they put together are comments that they make in great irritation. Is that's not fair.
Right.
And I think all human beings have a sense of fairness, you know, and justice. And I don't think of that quotation only in the Middle East. I think it for mankind, mm-hmm. worldwide. There isn't justice. We're not born equal. Yeah, we don't have equal opportunities.
That's true.
We were supposed to in many countries, but that doesn't always work. Life isn't fair. But I think the beauty of the poem is that we have love.
That's
true. We may not have justice, but as human beings, we do have love.
And I think that, you know, love, that's what actually triggered the book. As the reader actually goes and reads from the different, you know, chapters, you really feel the huge love that you have had, you know, and you still have for the country. And, you know, I also felt the love of your husband towards Jordan and, you know, as Arabs. And that really, you know, you feel it within the senses of the stories that you tell. So love was very important in your life, wasn't it?
Yes. I came from a loving home. And a loving family. And I think one of the major things that attracted me to my husband was his sense of values. He always was an Arab first, and then a Jordanian. And then, if it was of interest, a Christian.
Yes, that's
but
true.
But his major feeling was as an Arab, as a human being. And that's the way he lived his life, and I admired that.
You even, I think, you know, mentioned that he was balancing between the love to his parents and his love to you, and you sometimes even felt it wasn't fair.
Well, that's the patriarchal society and the expectations. He was raised to be the best son, to be the one to depend on, the one to raise the family, and that's what he was raised to do, whereas in the West, we're raised, hopefully, to meet our own potential.
That's true, to be independent.
That's right, to be independent. So he had a pull, and sometimes I pulled, and sometimes I let it go, because you can't fight it.
Right.
You know, it's who he was, and that was some of the best of who he was.
And I think that's why the string, you know, never ripped off, because you knew when to pull and when to let it go.
Well, if I didn't, I learned.
But I think it's also, you know, you learn about family relationships through this book, because it's, you know, you tell the different stories and different, you know, along the journey, there are different, you know, difficulties and how you manage to surpass them in order, you know, to keep this very tight and very close relationship. And I think that's something very important for the young generation to learn. And there's a story, actually, by reading the book in that sense. But weren't your relatives, you know, angry at you? I mean, you're like, oh, you mentioned me in such and such story and stuff like that, or you're not afraid?
They haven't read it yet.
Uh-oh.
Don't forget, actually, the book comes out officially tomorrow.
Yeah.
So nobody's really had their hands on it.
Oh, I see.
So I really don't know. I do hope that I wasn't unkind or unfair to anybody in the book. I do hope so. My father-in-law was a pioneer and a real character.
Yeah.
I mean, what he did in his life, I think he was bankrupted, if that's the right grammar, bankrupted. I'm not too sure. Anyway, about 13 times.
My God.
Yeah, seriously.
Wow.
And in his life. Some of it was Yes, because of the difficulties in the region and in Palestine, the strikes and the wars and so forth. And some of it was just bad judgment on his part. But he just simply plowed on.
Yeah.
And never let it get him down. And and some of the things he did, he didn't really know how to postpone pleasure. If he was hungry, he ate.
Wanted to sleep, he slept.
He slept, exactly. And he was a real character. And for me, a kind of character I never witnessed or was around when I was growing up.
But yes, but you really, you know, you accentuate in the book, you know, a lot about him. Mm. And you learn about from him, actually, through the different situations that he was in life, which is really admirable. But you mention also your friends, and I find it interesting that, I mean, for somebody who is living in Madaba, he will easily recognize the names, even if they're just, you know, nicknames of mother of or father
yes.
of. You could easily realize
yeah.
who you're talking about. But, you know, I kind of you were protective also of them, despite the fact you only talked about, you know, prominent, you know, characters and, you know, the certain situations that they have been. Because you learned from these situations, I suppose.
Of course. And I think the nature of situations, the accent of what's important to them was really revealing to me. Things mm-hmm. about the culture that I could never have learned otherwise. If I came to Jordan and moved into the Regency Palace Hotel.
Immediately.
Yes.
It would have been a total different life.
It would have
life.
Been a totally different life.
Of course.
But I didn't. And I lived the way people lived in Amman at that time. And I experienced things, but I didn't have the background to understand the import of it or why. And I still don't, actually. I will never really understand all of it. But part of who I am needs to understand. And they helped me.
I feel one of the reasons the book is very important, and I think it's a must read by any woman who plans to come to the Arab world, because you talk in such details about different customs and different life situations. Weddings, funerals, traditions of baptism, and all the other details. And I think, you know, nowhere you could read that. And there's no one to prepare you to the world that you're going to live in. So I feel that is a very important, you know, aspect that the book, what makes the book very important. But for you, do you feel that the customs actually are something hindering you? And do you feel that we should actually live and abide by them or try to struggle and just cut the chains off?
I think some of the customs, certainly in the beginning, I found excessive. I think that's the right word.
Yeah.
Just a bit much, you know, especially regarding death, the Aza and all of this. But, of course, as I matured as I lived here longer, lost people that I knew. I realized how comforting it is.
It is.
And how civilized.
Mm-hmm.
How civilized. I mean, what's more important in life than the people that you live with?
True.
And you associate with? This is makes your life.
Mm-hmm.
We're not isolated on a desert island somewhere, you know. And I think that some of these traditions, they may seem awkward, they may seem excessive, but I think they're really very meaningful.
So
very meaningful.
Do you consider yourself now part of the a tribe, Ashira?
Azizat.
Azizat.
Yeah. Well, if they'll have me. I don't know.
I think they already have you.
I just don't think of myself in those terms easily. I can't. I'm very proud of their history. I admire the courage, the history. I think, too, there's one word here that I mention in the book a bit, but it's been far more important in my life and in how I've looked at my life here, is the word survival.
That's true.
And I grew up in a society I didn't understand even the meaning of the word survival. And when I came here, I didn't realize right away that so much of what people do, so much that is enshrined in their tradition, really has to do with survival. And the whole idea of tribal life is survival.
Indeed.
Survival against an occupying power, survival against the elements, survival against neighboring tribes, survival.
Mm-hmm.
And once I started to realize that, I was far more accepting and understanding. I learned a lot.
In a village, when people used before to build, they used to go and bring stones and materials. So the woman will cook, you know, for the men who are building. Some will cut the stones, some will mix them. And, you know, when you think about the Regency Palace, when it was built, the last building, it also, you know, demonstrated that family union. When your late husband and his brother and everyone in the family, even the far, you know, relatives, were pitching out, you know, to help. Some were brought the elevator, some were bringing something else.
Yes.
So it's kind of like everything in your family is really, so everything in your life is demonstrating the family in its best, you know, form. And I think that's what you're trying to convey in the book.
I'm interested that you see it that way. Mm-hmm. I don't think I had a conscious plan to do that, quite mm-hmm. honestly. I know that here, because the tribal ties are so strong,
mm-hmm.
one would generally choose a tribal member over a stranger because you have some kind of control, you have some kind of communication, you have some kind of influence, even though that person may not be the best qualified. That's the way life goes here. And the fact that in building the Regency, the elevators and so forth, yes, probably because they were related, but also because they had the skill.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And so forth. Yeah. Because to do otherwise would not necessarily be the best decision. But those weren't my choices. Really, they weren't. They were my husband's. Yeah.
But if you weren't there to support him, I think, you know, things would have been...
Well, sometimes I didn't have a clue what he was doing, of course. I think if he had asked me my advice or opinion on a lot of things, I wouldn't have been nearly as helpful. I think it was far better he did. He knew his people.
Right. Uh-huh.
He knew his country. He knew the psychology. He knew when to make a fuss. He knew when to just be quiet. And that's beyond what I could do. No way I could understand that.
Most people will feel envious that you have been living in a hotel all your life. And they say, oh, my God, you know, she's so lucky. She could ask room service. She'll have, you know, somebody to do the maintenance. But in reality, that wasn't the case. It's the life of a struggle when you had to do the sheets and cook sometimes and do everything. Mm. And I loved even the fact that your daughter, you know, was operating. So, you know, do you really regret, you know, all this, you know, living in the hotel and, you know, the aftermath of it? Or you think that it was worth the struggle?
Oh, that's a difficult question to really answer that easily. My goodness. You know, you do change how you feel over the years. Mm-hmm. In the beginning, I really struggled and fought to have a house to live like I would expect normal families to live. And I realized it just wasn't going to work. My husband needed to be a hands-on manager. That's how he lived his life. That's how he ran his business. And for me to separate myself from that, I would only be lonely. Mm-hmm. And so it was just easier to stay in the hotel with him. In the beginning, I worked alongside him.
Yeah.
I mean, when we were, it was a small operation, and I would help. I actually managed it for about 10 years.
In Jerusalem, mm-hmm. That's true.
Which really wasn't a tremendous feat of energy or. I just was there, and things ran their own way because it was a simple hotel, simple operation. But when I moved to Amman, there was no way I could get involved, really.
Mm-hmm.
It's better not to.
It's too complicated.
And it's too confusing for the help. I mean, who's the boss?
Right. Uh-huh. Who's managing
system? Who's managing it? To me, it would be very self-defeating to get involved.
Were you scared when your son decided to continue the business and open his own hotel? I mean, what did you tell, you know, your daughter-in-law? Like, you know, oh, you get prepared, you're going to go through all that trouble, or you think they managed on their own? How was it?
I never thought about it at all, actually, I must say. It just evolved.
Uh-huh.
It just simply evolved. And my daughter-in-law certainly is up to any challenge. And I'm very proud of her as a partner and helpmate to my son. But I never really thought about my children's future, what they decide to do or not.
They had their own life.
They had their own life, and to me, they have the right to make these choices.
So that was more like the American point of view on life, you know, like, rather than the kids being operated, if I could use the word, you know, by their parents and their fate decided by their parents. You actually gave them the essence of life, and you left them to choose. And you don't regret that?
No. It's their life. I mean, the choices that they've all made at different times, sometimes I've not been privy to whatever led up to the choice.
Even when they made mistakes that you felt, you know, that you could have, you know, protected them from those mistakes?
You try. You try. At the end of the day, I believe a person, a grown-up, is responsible for his own decisions. And as a parent, if I didn't instill that in them, I would feel I'd failed them.
Mm-hmm. I see. In reality, when you... You know, as an American, and we talk about American mentality, you come from the land of the free, where you have democracy, where you have, you know, everything, you know, like the law. And you came to Palestine because your husband decided to open a business there. And you ended up with all that struggle. You know, you've seen the Intifada, you've seen, you know, the occupation first, and then the war, and all the shelling. You know, how did it feel? You know, was it really the feeling of injustice, that the hopelessness that you can't do anything? Or, you know, I hate my husband, why did he drag me here? I don't want to be here. How did you feel?
Well, in the first place, I didn't blame my husband.
Mm-hmm.
He may have blamed himself, but I didn't blame my husband at all. It's the turn of events and the way things happened. I think, and I don't think I put this in the book, but the most shocking realization I had right after the occupation in Jerusalem by Israeli troops and Israel was to suddenly understand what a black American felt like in the United States. I mean, it hit me really hard. Our cars, the license plates on our cars were 630, so that anywhere we went in the country of Israel, and we went on the West Bank or inside Jerusalem, it was known that this car is driven by an Arab, or this car is owned by an Arab. Our identity cards identified us, our last name identified us, but the color didn't.
Right.
But for a black American, there is no escape at all.
Right.
He has the color of his skin. And I think the biggest realization was, gosh, now I know how
they feel.
Some people can feel, you know. And that was a good lesson.
Yeah, it was a hard one, though.
Yeah.
You say that Americans generally are naive in how they look into life. And you know, coming to the Middle East and particularly to Palestine, you understood, you know, how naive Americans look at life, you know. They don't know where Jordan is. They don't understand what is the situation, what are people facing. And, you know, how did that make you feel? Although when you came to Jordan, you really, you know, you tried your best with a group, you know, of other expatriates to make a stand.
Mm.
But you felt that even your government did not understand you. And why are you taking that stand?
That's a big question. That's really a big question. Americans, don't forget, I don't think anybody really appreciates how large America is. It's a very big country.
That's true.
And Americans, particularly who live in cities and so forth, the time it takes them to get to work. My daughter, who lives in Washington, it takes her over 1 hour each way to get to her job. And when she gets home, how much time does she have? She has to cook. But, yeah, I mean, is she dying to read the newspaper? What's going on?
Of course not.
It's very difficult to get involved in political action groups and this kind of thing. It's just so difficult for most Americans. They don't even think about it. And, of course, our concept of government is you elect a representative who should look out for your interests. And then if you approve of how they behave, you reelect them. And if you don't, you don't reelect them. Well, somehow this whole system has broken down, I think, in so many ways. And life is so complicated. And the tragedy for me as an American is that America's powerful. And it's doing things that are really not very American. And as an American, I'm upset, but there isn't much I can do about it.
Yeah, you're per se, you know, you're caught between two cultures.
Yeah.
Between a person who is experiencing something on the ground and at the same time between, you know, your identity. So the government per se expects you that you're going to support them, you know, whatever they are doing. And at the same time, you know, your culture and your new family, you know, your kids are Jordanians and Arabs. So, you know, it's kind of clash of identity or where you are and where your loyalties are, you know. I think that's very difficult that you had to go through at some points in your life.
I think it took me 10 years after I came to Jordan to accept the fact that I wouldn't disintegrate if I changed my feelings or my opinion about my identity as an American. I think it's a bad word, I suppose, brainwashed, but I think we're all brainwashed, no matter who we are or what country we're raised in. It's the process of growing up. It's what influences us and what forms what we think is normal, what we take for granted.
Right.
And it's really brainwashing, I suppose, in a way. So, but to come here and live the first 10 years that I did here or more and realize that my country says one thing and actually does another, it was really hard. I was trying to make excuses for them. I was trying. And Sammy, bless him, he would just look at me. He never argued.
Right.
And it was at some point, I was either going to wake up and see the reality for what it was or not.
Mm-hmm.
It was my choice. And it took a long time.
But you woke up.
I woke up, yes. Not much I can do about it, but it's kind of nice to be awake.
Yeah, that's true. It's a hard decision to be, you know. Yeah, and especially when you when your mom came and your, you know, brothers and, you know, the relatives, they started to look at things from your own perspective, which is also an eye-opener. And I think that's important. So in reality, what was the main message that you wanted to convey in the book? Was it actually, it's not only memoirs. It's far beyond than that.
Well, hopefully, to share what my experiences are, whether the reader will come to the same kind of conclusions that I did. Living it, I have no idea. But if I don't share it, they're not going to know anything. And I think that 50 years of living in another country doesn't make me an expert by any means, but it does give me a feeling for comparison and what's different. And if that comes across in the book, and readers who are American or interested readers who don't understand, you know, Jordan or the Arab world, if they can come to a conclusion that, there is an injustice here. There are people here who have lives.
Mm-hmm.
These people, too, have dreams and lives. And it would be a better world if we were more respectful or understanding and forgiving.
I think, you know, that's a very important message, is to bridge the gap and bring, you know, different cultures and people together. But you had also a unique opportunity when you were living in a hotel, when you seen all those celebrities. How did it make you feel, you know, when you open the door and, you know, you find a very important politician there, or, you know, a very important person?
Well, those really, those days were few and far between. They really were. I mean, some of them I never actually met.
Right.
For instance, when President Yasser Arafat was across the hall from me for 2 weeks or whatever, I forgot. Now, I never actually set eyes on the man. And I'm too short to look through the peephole of the door, so I couldn't see from there. But I actually never did meet him. And I don't feel it's important somehow. It's an honor for the hotel to be able to serve these people, and I hope that they, all of them, left in the different times and periods that they were there, feeling that they had been served well. But for me personally, it's, I don't know, not part of what I really care about. I don't know. I don't know how to say it, but yeah.
I think you just look at them, that they are just one of those who are occupants in the hotel. And, you know, okay, they're here, then they're there, you know. So, because I think the important is not the celebrity as much as the communication with that person. And if you don't feel that, you know, so it kind of... But you're, you know, you reflect on a lot of people, and that's also very interesting, because there are different stories in the book about important people. And it's very interesting how the different, the kitchens of the Regency were not only cooking food, but also cooking politics. And I think that's an interesting, you know, aspect there for sure. But when you live in a hotel and you know all the secrets and the background, and when you go to another hotel, how do you feel? I mean, are you really, you know, like critical? You know, I know that you should be doing this better. Yeah. How is it?
Well, I think I'm far more sympathetic than someone who didn't know. I know what it's like with staff that come, that you hire, that are really, their skills and languages are not good enough. Their home background doesn't allow them to serve a lady first.
Oh,
you know, these things.
That's true.
I'm so aware of these things, the details of what kind of make the hotel go round, than I am, you know, not picky in that sense, but I'm more sensitive, you know, to other things that you might not see, you know, or care
true.
About.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
You understand, you see the effort.
Yes.
I mean, for us, you could see the full plate, you know, and you could enjoy and savor the food. But you look at it at the whole process of a preparation and how it was made.
Mm.
At the same time, I feel that both you and your husband played a very important role in advancing the hospitality business in Jordan. So do you feel that his legacy is going on, you know, through the different institutions that are there? How do you feel towards that?
Well, you very kindly said my husband and me. No, not me, my husband. Very keen sense of wanting to raise the level of all Jordanians, and particularly the one area that he was able to do, which are hotel employees. The service industry, the travel industry, which he had influence of. And he really, it was a very important thing for him, because as I tell in the book, when I first came, the employees that my father-in-law had downtown Amman, I mean, there was no such thing as hotel industry when I came. You didn't have any kind of union. You didn't have any training whatsoever. So as Jordan started to grow so quickly and tourism started to grow very quickly, the infrastructure was lagging. We had to get busy, and it's exciting. It's exciting to see that you have culinary schools. You have the hotel training school. You have different, I don't even know all the technical things, schools that are available to train. It's wonderful.
For you, when you came, I mean, Amman was, you know, just downtown, and it started to grow. How do you feel, you know, how could you describe Amman? How do you feel towards the city?
it's a city. I don't know. It was curious because I read that question or one very similar that you had put in it. I really don't know how to answer it. I've only lived in a few cities in my life, and a city is a city. It has a lot of problems in so many different ways. The services of cities, infrastructure, parking, traffic, availability of services, and so forth, which as a resident you experience not always in the best way.
It's true, you know.
But you demand them, you need them, you want them. As the city grows, these needs must be met. And it's beyond me to really. Amman just grew. Amman's a huge city now.
But I mean, for you, do you consider it a second home? Do you consider it? It's a place where your, you know, kids were born, and you know, in a sense, you know, made their future. Is it a sentimental view of the city? You know, because for example, Jerusalem, you had some sentiment with it. In a sense, that's how I felt. You know, because you felt sorry. You know, when you left it. But Amman, how do you feel? How do you interact with it? I mean, when somebody asks you, well, what would you relate it to?
I don't somehow. I don't know how to. I don't really know how to answer that. I feel an affinity to the events and to people. For instance, in Jerusalem, I was never very happy in Jerusalem. We worked very hard. I always felt a stranger.
I see.
There. And then, of course, under occupation and all, it's not a pleasant place to live.
It's not a pleasant experience.
No, not at all. So I wasn't unhappy to leave, quite honestly. My husband was, because it was a little corner in his life where he was kind of free from Madaba, from Azizat, from the constant pressures and demands in for the most part. And he was kind of his own boss, period. And it was he enjoyed that. It was harder for him than for me. And Detroit, I feel proud that I was a Detroiter, but yet now it's a bankrupt city. You
That's
know,
true. Yeah.
I would like to place my feeling of belonging in a bigger sphere.
Mm-hmm. To the world.
to the world rather than to just a city.
Uh-huh. I see. So actually traveling around and, you know, seeing, you know, you feel probably because you look at the hotel as a microcosmo when you have people coming from all around the world and you actually provide them with services and you meet with them and mingle with them. Somehow nationalities and places, you know, drop when the people come through the door. I think, you know, so you more belong to the big hotel industry or the hotel world.
in a way, it's... it's fun to hear people in the elevator talking, not knowing that I'm, you know, important in the hotel, that I can understand them and hear. And if they're saying something nice, it's also good to hear when they're complaining a little bit too, because you learn something. But
sneaking around on people,
sneaking around. Well, it's there for the hearing, you know. And I don't have nearly as much interaction as I had in Jerusalem because it was a smaller hotel. And I had my gift shop.
Yes, that's true.
Yes. And so I was mingling with the guests every day. In the Regency, not really.
Mm-hmm.
No, not like
just
that.
Just if you're, you know...
By chance,
exactly.
By chance, yeah.
But is there another place that you like to go in Amman? Do you like to go shopping? Do you like to go to a certain place, historical place... Do you enjoy social life in Amman? How is it?
Well, since Sammy died, my social life, of course, has changed dramatically. And I'm getting older. I'm not really as enthusiastic as I used to be about a lot of things and events. I'm extremely proud of the Amman Symphony Orchestra. I am proud of the advances that Jordan has made in the arts.
Mm-hmm.
And museum and all of this. This is exciting to see, because for so many years there was just really nothing. There was really nothing, and it's wonderful to see growth and the variety and the diversity and the doors opening for people of talent.
Right.
That there's some way that they can express themselves, and that would be appreciated. And this is nice. This is really nice.
Tomorrow you're going to have the grand signing and the launch of the book. And Her Royal Highness Princess Muna Al-Hussein, who actually even graced the book with her introduction, is going to be there. How do you feel? I mean, are you anxious, worried? You know, how do you feel about that?
Anticipation is an important part of life for me. And I'm anticipating of a nice event. And I'm so honored that Her Royal Highness was so supportive, and she truly was. And she wrote the recommendation before I found a publisher.
Wow.
And I do believe that her recommendation helped me secure a publisher, quite honestly. So
when you, this is the first cooperation you have with the Al-Madina Publishers.
Yes.
And how was it? You know, was it a difficult path, you know, to publish the book? And how did you find the cooperation with them? Will they be present tomorrow at the signing?
They better be.
Okay.
Yes, no, they will be. And don't forget, this is their book. I don't know much about publishing. I'm learning. But when you sign with a publisher, they own your book, and which is only right, because they're investing money.
Mm-hmm.
And it's their job to promote, you know, the book and to sell the book, which is what they do. And as professionals, it's great for myself to self-publish. It was always an option in the back of my mind. And I know of a few people who have gone that route. And for me, it just isn't a possibility. I don't want to have to worry about selling my books. I don't want to have piles and piles of books in my apartment to trip over because I can't seem to move them. So I'm honored and pleased and relieved that I have a publisher. I met them when they came for the book launch of Princess Alia's book, Small Wonders.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it was a very fast, amicable meeting. And Kitty Carruthers, the director of Medina, immediately was happy to take the book. She read it, of course, the manuscript that I had. It wasn't finished, but what I had. And I just couldn't believe it, just like that.
I think they recognize a good book when they see one.
Thank you.
My last question, and I was wondering, how did your kids react when you decided to write these memoirs? Were they welcoming, apprehensive? How did they feel?
I think it's been going on for such a long time. I really don't know what they feel because, bless them, they haven't really read it. I think my son has read quite a bit of it. But my daughters haven't really read it all. Although my one daughter, my oldest daughter, I needed her approval on one section of the book that was quite personal.
That. Yes.
And she was more than happy to give it to me.
She's gracious.
Yes.
It's not
truly,
easy.
Yeah.
Yes.
They're so supportive. And in fact, as I said, this anticipation is building up to the point that I'm tickled. I'm just tickled to death that I was able to do this and that it's being received so well. I didn't think about it. I didn't expect it.
Well, I would like to congratulate you on this really wonderful book. I think it really is going to add a lot to the library of Jordanians and also to the expatriates and foreigners who are coming to Jordan. It was written, as I said, with lots of love. It has a lot of witty remarks, you know, a nice sense of humor. And it really talks to the heart of the people there. For all of you who are going to be tomorrow in Amman on the 14th of December, please, you know, just make your way to the Regency and go, to, you know, at 6 p.m. for the wonderful, you know, signing off of the book. I really, you know, wish you a very, you know, calm and nice signing. And I hope that everything will be, you know, so well. So 6 p.m. tomorrow, you know, make sure that you're all head to the Regency. And dear listeners, allow me in your name to thank our guest, Mrs. Anne Hutchinson-Sawalha, for her warm talk and to wish you and your families, both close, the extended and the professional, all the best. We invite you all to acquire this very important publication through the Palace Keyhole. Don't miss the grand signing at 6 p.m. at the Regency Hotel. Special thanks go to our sound technician, Mr. Bedrik Tlaish, and to the wonderful Shima Tal, who was accompanying us all the time. Dear listeners, thank you for being with us. Hope you have enjoyed enjoyed today's talk. If you missed it, make sure to tune in on a replay on Tuesday from 8 to 9 p.m. We will be here next Saturday from 6:30 to 7:30 with a new guest at Amman, the Heartly Embrace. Thank you. Dear listeners, thank you for tuning in to Hawa Amman 105.9 and welcome to a new program, Amman the Heartly Embrace, prepared by Nasser Rahamni and Shima Tal and presented by Katrina Hamane. In the program, we glimpse at our lovely city Amman through the eyes of diplomats and foreigners, catching their views, interactions and experiences, learn about their organizations, projects, initiatives and contributions to the city. Broadcasted on Saturday from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. and a replay on Tuesday from 8 to 9 p.m.